content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 6th, September 13th issue of the Week. As noted last week, this is a two-week issue, and last week I described the cover drawing, and we did some of the main stories. We'll go a little deeper this week, and I'm sure we'll get a new issue next week, and I'm sure we'll have something about the Harris-Trump debate that went down last night. So, we're going to start off today reading the briefing and go from there. Agriculture feels the heat. Climate change and extreme weather are taking a toll on crops from corn to coffee, jeopardizing the global food supply. How big is the problem? About three-quarters of farmland worldwide is vulnerable to significant climate disruptions, according to Jonas Jägermeier, a climate scientist and crop modeler with NASA. That's partly a result of rising heat. The 10 hottest years on record have all occurred since 2014, and partly because that warming makes extreme weather events such as heat waves, floods, and cyclones more frequent and destructive. The number of such events has increased some 400% over the past 50 years, causing significant damage to food systems. Climate-related disasters such as hurricanes and wildfires destroy infrastructure like roads and bridges, making it more difficult to transport food to people. They also wreak havoc on farms, wiping out crops and harvests. Droughts can degrade the quality of soil, and recurrent floods can wash it away, rendering farmland barren or limiting the quantity and quality of what grows. The insurer Lloyd's estimates there's a 50% risk of food shock, in which a multi-year period of extreme weather leads to major crop failures, mass starvation, social unrest, and a global recession in the next 30 years. Saving the food system, says Jägermeier, is the challenge of our generation. Which crops will be worst hit? The casualties are wide-ranging. California lettuce crops turned yellow during a July heat wave. Olive oil prices have tripled in recent years as heat waves scorched southern Europe. And a drought in Vietnam shrunk the planet's supply of Robusta coffee beans. More worrying is the forecast for corn, which provides a fifth of human caloric intake. Crop yields in the U.S. Corn Belt will drop 40% by late century, a result of rising temperatures and water shortages, according to a University of Connecticut study. That trend will be repeated around the globe. NASA researchers expect corn yields worldwide to drop by an average of 24% over the same period. Rice, a staple relied on by an estimated 3 billion people, faces a similar threat. In China, extreme rainfall has reduced yields over the past two decades. India has cut rice exports out of fear of shortages at home. And in California, farmers in 2022 let more than half of the state's 550,000 acres of rice fields lie fallow after years of drought. Without the water, we have dirt, said farmer Matthew Garcia. It's basically worthless. Some food staples, though, could see a short-term boost as a result of climate change. What crops might do better? A 2021 NASA study found that anticipated climate changes could boost wheat yields by 17%. That's because rising temperatures and shifts in rainfall may allow the grain to be grown in areas that were once too frigid, including parts of the northern U.S., Canada, and Central Asia. But those gains are expected to level off by mid-century, and other parts of the world will see sharp declines. Temperature and rainfall are not the only climate change-related factors that affect yields. Higher levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide from human activity increase photosynthesis, resulting in more growth in wheat and certain other crops. But that growth burst is often accompanied by decreased nutrient content, with levels of zinc, iron, protein, and vitamins dropping. By 2050, hundreds of millions of people could slip below the minimum thresholds of these nutrients needed for good health, said Harvard researcher Samuel Myers. And the more than 2 billion already deficient could see their conditions worsen. How will climate change affect food prices? It'll push them higher. Wholesale food prices have increased 50% globally since 1999 due to a combination of factors such as climate change, conflicts like the war in Ukraine, and COVID-era supply chain problems. And rising temperature alone could cause global food prices to increase by up to 3.2% annually by 2035, according to German researchers. Price spikes, food shortages, and hunger. Some 333 million people don't have enough food to meet their dietary needs, more than double the number pre-pandemic, can snowball into other problems, sparking unrest, conflict, and mass migration. There were an unprecedented 12,500 protests worldwide over the cost of food and other essentials in 2022. And a study by South Korean researchers found that rising temperatures and reduced corn yields will increase civil conflict in the sub-Saharan Africa by more than 30% from 2030 to 2050. Can food systems be strengthened? More land could be dedicated to crops. One study suggests 1.5 billion acres of new farmland will be needed to meet demand, nearly the size of two Indias. But that would involve the mass felling of forest, which trap planet-heating carbon, increasing emissions from agriculture. Already, the sector is responsible for about a quarter of global carbon emissions, mostly through deforestation to clear the land. Adaptation may be necessary. The State Department has launched an initiative to help some African farmers return to growing traditional, sturdy, and nutrient-rich crops like cassava and millet. And genetic engineering and other biotech techniques can help create staples better suited to our changing climate. A lab at the University of California, Davis, has developed flood-resistant rice varieties that are now being grown by 6 million subsistence farmers in India and Bangladesh. There's some pushback to genetically engineered crops, but Daniel Nepstad, head of the Earth Innovation Institute, a research group, says we have few other options. Human civilization, he says, is at a point where we just have to get a lot more from less. And we'll circle back to the best columns and read a few of the ones we didn't get to last week. Starting with America's anti-child party. J.D. Vance and Republicans claim that one of our major political parties is anti-family and anti-kid, said Nicholas Kristof. It's true, but it's members of the GOP who should look in the mirror and hang their heads in shame. Congressional Republicans killed President Biden's refundable child tax credit, which had cut child poverty by 50%. Republican-controlled states refused to expand Medicaid, and children in those states have higher death rates. Thanks to Republicans' insistence on lax gun laws, gun violence is the leading cause of death for people 19 and under. The red states have higher high school dropout rates and divorce rates, and because of Republican opposition to sex education and freely available contraception, have much higher rates of teenage pregnancy. Like Vance, some Republicans want to eliminate no-fault divorce, which has cut domestic abuse rates by 25%. Democrats should do more to support children and families, but it should be no surprise that the party that fails them most egregiously is the one led by the thrice-married tycoon who abuses and denigrates women. Trump makes it awkward for Republicans to preach family values, but the MAGA cult is without irony or shame. This comes from Norway. Destroying our fisheries and our good name. Norway is the world's biggest exporter of farmed salmon, said Lars Held. But how long will we stay on top of the industry if the industry keeps inflicting one wound after another on itself? The fisheries are in crisis. So many fish have been contracting infections and dying in the open net pens where they are raised that food safety experts say there is a real danger of biological collapse. Worse, the farmed salmon are contaminating wild salmon too. Many farmed fish, especially those raised in the fjords, have been escaping and infecting their wild cousins with diseases or salmon lice. This summer, a number of salmon rivers had to be closed to fishing because of such outbreaks. And now even the ocean is at risk. An expose by Dagens Nervisliv revealed that fish hatcheries have been pumping polluted, cloudy water directly into the sea, where wild fish ingest a cocktail of feces, fish feed, and sludge. Instead of addressing the problem, though, the industry has simply put out a new PR campaign assuring consumers that salmon can't transmit disease to humans, as if that were the worry. If the fisheries don't take concrete steps to improve fish health, the entire industry will be at risk. Consumers can just choose something else for dinner. Fishers, though, would be out of a livelihood. This column comes from the Congo. Don't leave Africa to fight Mpox alone. The resurgence of Mpox should be a wake-up call for the world, said Richard Mihigo. Since a global epidemic of the disease broke out just 2 years ago, Africa ought to have been prepared to head off a new outbreak. After all, the virus formerly known as monkeypox was first identified decades ago, and we have a vaccine for it. Yet we could not contain the more deadly variant that has spilled out of the Democratic Republic of Congo to other countries in an outbreak that the World Health Organization has labeled as a global health emergency. That's because there are only 200,000 doses of vaccine available worldwide, while in East Africa alone, several million doses are needed to effectively respond to the threat. Our inability to ramp up vaccine production is a harsh reminder of how weak our health systems are against emerging diseases like Ebola, Marburg virus, dengue, and chikungunya. But it's not just Africa's failure. While our continent is currently bearing the brunt of the human cost of this outbreak, it should not have to bear the economic burden alone, especially because what starts in Africa won't stay there. If we had the help of rich countries, we could not only contain but also eradicate the virus and save lives across the planet. And we'll pick up a couple of the business columns as well this week. Traffic jam. Automakers hit reverse on electric vehicles. Automakers are pulling the plug on their grand EV ambition, said Mike Colias and Christopher Ottz in the Wall Street Journal. Ford announced last week it was scrapping plans for a three-row battery-powered sport utility vehicle it once touted as a personalized bullet train. It joins the growing list of car companies, including General Motors, Volkswagen, and Mercedes, that have curbed their EV plans in recent months as demand softens and costs for batteries and other components rise. Ford said it was losing an astonishing $44,000 on every electric vehicle it sold and is on pace to lose $5 billion this year on its EV efforts. Still, despite the uncertain demand picture, auto executives say they aren't walking away from the EV market, which continues to grow year over year. Ford, for instance, is pivoting towards smaller, more affordable electric cars and plug-in hybrids, a middle ground hedge that buyers seem to favor. But smaller isn't traditionally a winning strategy for U.S. automakers, said Patrick George in The Atlantic. America is still overwhelmingly a truck and SUV country, in part because our automakers have convinced buyers that small equates to dinky or even unsafe. Now Ford's bet hinges on removing such deep-seated ideas, trying to get Americans to buy still another batch of models they don't want would be right in line with the approach the government has foisted on automakers, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The Biden administration is hell-bent on forcing an EV into every American garage, and manufacturers have been given little choice but to comply. The Environmental Protection Agency is demanding that U.S. companies produce nearly four electric trucks for each gasoline-powered model by 2032. When automakers bleed red ink trying to comply with the government's mandates, will taxpayers rescue them? Hybrids may be a sensible middle ground, said Joe Lancaster in Reason. Americans are clearly hesitant to embrace an entirely gasoline-free future. The plug-in route was Toyota's bet years ago. It focused on hybrids while other automakers embraced EVs wholeheartedly, and it has since reaped the rewards. Unfortunately, the EPA's standards favor battery EVs over hybrids. That's because we don't know if people are actually plugging in hybrids, said John Volker in InsideEVs.com. A hybrid left uncharged is essentially a gas-powered car that's heavier and potentially has more emissions from lugging around a battery pack. The politics of EVs could end up swinging the presidential race in surprising ways, said Errol Lewis in New York Magazine. Donald Trump has promised to undo Biden's EV initiatives, appealing to a base that prefers buying gas guzzlers, though he has tempered his opposition since he got Tesla chief Elon Musk's endorsement. But politically, what matters most is not who buys EVs, but where the cars and trucks are manufactured. Key states such as Michigan, Wisconsin, and Georgia, where voters might not buy a lot of electric cars, but like the jobs and money that come from making them. The heroic work of the unsung CPA. A lot is riding on the campaign to save America's most boring profession, said Emmalise Brownstein. Certified public accountants can do plenty with their skills. Forensic accountants working at the FBI. Auditors helping a Fortune 500 company analyze the books of a hotshot business it's considering acquiring. But try telling that to a young person. Gen Z is the first generation to have truly grown up with social media, and accounting isn't readily Instagrammable. Most CPA candidates need a master's degree, and then comes the grueling four-part CPA exam. Students can get higher-paying and arguably more exciting finance jobs right out of college without doing all that. About 65,000 students in the U.S. completed a degree in accounting in the 2021-22 school year, 18% fewer than a decade earlier. At the same time, three-quarters of the existing CPAs in the U.S. are thought to be at or near retirement age. The nationwide accountant shortage doesn't just mean that the neighborhood CPA will take longer to finish your tax return. The entire capital market system depends on reliable accountants and auditors. Unfortunately, the image problem will take a lot of time and money to fix when even retired senior accountants admit that the pay is crappy, the hours long, and the work is drudgery. And we'll read the last word, our feature article, title this week, The Ransomware Negotiator. When companies get hacked, they have two goals, said Amanda Chicago Lewis in The Economist's 1843 magazine. Keep it quiet and minimize the payout. That's where Nick Shaw comes in. Last autumn, somewhere in Europe, a security operations center noticed something. This is the primary job of a security operations center, to notice things. Its role is simple, protecting organizations by tracking the people using their computer networks. Its name is often abbreviated to a simple acronym, SOC, pronounced SOC. The people who work at a SOC are the cybersecurity equivalent of night guards at the mall, sitting at a bank of television screens, watching, waiting, trying not to doze off. In this case, when they noticed, what they noticed was someone trying to log in to a staff member's account at one of the companies the SOC monitors, using a series of incorrect passwords, about 1,000 times in one day. This seemed suspicious. Someone at the SOC sent someone at the company an email letting them know about the failed logins. The cybersecurity industry exists to keep information secret and reputations intact. I am able to tell you this story only if I keep the company in question anonymous, though you might have heard of it. Picture a company that provides boring administrative services to thousands of organizations across the planet. Both the SOC, the SOC, and the company were certified as meeting the world's best-known standard for information security. But when the SOC alerted the company's staff to the failed logins, they did nothing. The SOC didn't press the issue. No one noticed that the user was eventually able to log in. No one noticed that it was an administrator-level account, which provided access to the company's entire network. No one noticed anything amiss for about a month. Then one day, the company's servers began malfunctioning. A series of alarming emails arrived. Quote, we managed to obtain a lot of secret documents, internal documents classified as strictly confidential, personal data of current employees, read one. There was a link to a private chat room and a deadline for using it. The hackers wanted to talk. Some hours later, a phone rang on the other side of the world. Nick Shaw was asleep at his beach house on the tropical island of Mauritius in the middle of the Indian Ocean. When he picked up, it was a colleague with bad news. Someone at the company had gone into the secure chat without consulting them and sent the hackers two messages. Hello, the link supplied to initiate communication did not work. We have only just located an alternative link that does work. It is almost 2 a.m. UK time, and we need an extension to discuss specifics around this incident with you. We will contact you by 11 a.m. BST time. 12 minutes later, the hackers wrote back, hello, okay. Shaw picked up his vape pen and took a pull. The company was panicking, of course. The agitated tone, the rushed timeline. These messages were going to make Shaw's job harder. Every interaction with criminals is a psychological power game, and the company had just ceded ground. Shaw needed to craft a reply to get this conversation back on track, and quickly. Most people would call Shaw a ransomware negotiator. At 55, he may be one of the world's most calculating conversationalists, though he hides it well. He has a pleasant, forgettable demeanor, soft face, average height, average build. Born in Uganda to Indian immigrants, he moved to the UK at age 4. At 18, his only plan was not to be poor anymore. He joined the police and worked his way up from secret street patrols to covert operations. By his 40s, he was working for a unit at the UK's National Crime Agency that handles international kidnapping and hostage situations. He then spent 6 years stationed in South Africa, managing missions from Mozambique to Malawi, before retiring in 2019 with a medal from the Queen. Although he'd left government, he wanted to keep working on transnational crime and decided to settle in Mauritius. There, he got to know a man in the cybersecurity business called Neil Hare Brown, who, like him, had a background in law enforcement. A decade or so ago, Hare Brown noticed a rise in insurance companies offering cybercrime policies and thought there might be a demand for a firm that could perform risk assessments and investigations for them. He started Storm Guidance in 2014, and Shaw came on board 5 years later. The most pressing question for Shaw now was what data had been taken. Was it just the material pertaining to the company itself, or had the hackers figured out how to get into the files of its clients, who numbered in the thousands? Shaw's first goal was to slow everything down so that his counterparts on Storm's technical team had time to do some digging. He decided to limit messages to working hours in the country where the company was based. No one's life is at risk, he reminded himself. The hackers could gain the upper hand if Shaw revealed himself as a professional negotiator. If he pretended to be a low-level employee at the company, Shaw could build in opportunities for future delays, as the hackers would expect it to take time to get an answer from a supervisor. This sounds really bad, he explained, but I tend to sign off the first ones as a female, because criminals are criminals and they still have that in their head. A senior person is normally a male. He dictated a message over the phone to be sent a few hours later. Hello, we are unclear on what data you actually have. Please provide details. Many thanks, Julia, IT Administration. Then he rolled over and went back to sleep. 3.5 hours after Julia sent her first message, the ransomware gang wrote back, Hello, are you authorized to conduct a dialogue? Then, after 1.5 hours passed with no reply, you should visit the chat more often and check messages. Shaw politely held firm on his initial request. My manager has asked me to respond to you. We are unclear on what data you actually have. Can you send us details or a file tree? I will then pass this on to management. The ransomware gang sent a link to an encrypted compressed file, the digital equivalent of a proof of life. Storm's team opened it and looked through what had been taken from the company's networks. It didn't seem as bad as they'd expected. Luckily, said Ben Muldoon, Storm's senior cyber investigator, there was a very, very limited amount of client data in there, and it wasn't sensitive stuff. But then came a volley of threatening messages. We have already penetrated your client's networks. We used your passwords and can clearly see a map of the networks of all victims. Shaw prefers to ignore attempts at intimidation, a lesson he learned during hostage negotiations. Allowing emotion into the conversation wastes time and risks unnecessarily provoking the kidnapper. In composing a response, he adopted a blandly corporate tone, throwing in phrases such as, Thank you for your patience, and I look forward to hearing from you at your earliest convenience. Shaw would never be the first one to bring up payment. If you start talking about money, he said, you're literally throwing the carrot at them and hit them on the head. At this point, it had been only a couple of days since the company had realized it had been breached. The chief executive was determined to protect the company's reputation and keep its clients in the dark for as long as possible. Shaw and Hare Brown were concerned about this approach. As the company had government contracts, it was difficult to know whether their servers might contain sensitive information. But the company's chief executive chose to trust the proof of life file was comprehensive. The attack would remain secret for now. Shaw expected the gang to ask her for $5 million. Muldoon, alarmed by the forensic information about the company's servers, guessed that the demand would be more like $15 million. So when the message came in, both were surprised. The amount of payment will be $2 million. Either they don't know what company they're actually dealing with, or they haven't done their research properly, Shaw said. For several days, Shaw sent the gang courteous messages at Julia, delaying any significant negotiations around the ransom demand. He signed off, "I will update you soonest." The chief executive was starting to realize how lucky he was that the gang had not pushed their advantage to the fullest. After a few days of persuading, he got the board to approve paying the $2 million. Shaw said that wouldn't be necessary. He drafted another message. "Good morning. The management team have asked me to discuss with you a settlement. As you will, I'm sure, understand, we do not have the financial means to meet your current price. It is far outside our capabilities and unachievable. We feel that an appropriate settlement can be achieved that will satisfy both parties and conclude matters quickly. However, this figure would need to be much lower." Shaw wanted the gang to think it was getting what it wanted, even as he pretended that the company couldn't afford its demands. To signal to the gang that he was serious, he even changed his legend, signing off Christopher, HR manager. Less than 15 minutes later, a hacker wrote back, "I will discuss and answer you in half an hour." Follow-up arrived 8 minutes after that. "Hi, Christopher. Let's not bargain and waste both your and our time. You say that this amount is too much for you, and in this case, our head told me that we can make a discount. Tell me the amount your counteroffer, but it certainly can't be small, so we might as well just get up and leave. Tell me the amount within 1 hour from the moment you read this message." Shaw let 2 hours pass. "Good afternoon. Thank you for your reply. I will convey your message to the management team. Any response will take some time, as any decisions will need to be discussed. This will not be within an hour. It is in neither of our interests to waste time, and we are certainly eager to resolve this matter as quickly as possible. If you were able to provide me with a revised price, I can share that with them, and I am more confident that a resolution could be reached much sooner. I look forward to hearing from you at your earliest convenience. Thank you, Christopher, HR manager." 9 minutes later, the hackers wrote, "We are ready to close the issue completely and without unnecessary bidding in the amount of $700,000. The chief executive was now desperate for the problem to go away and happy to pay $700,000. Shaw could feel the antsy energy on both sides, but he was reluctant to fold. He waited almost 20 hours to write again, and when he did, he told the hackers that he was still awaiting a decision. And then, a few hours later, Shaw made Christopher from HR do something bold. In the middle of a long, exceedingly polite note, he wrote, "We currently have $179,500 available to us that we can provide you quickly." The gang accepted the offer. "We appreciate your desire to resolve this issue." Storm ran a sanctions check, then helped the company send a test payment of $99 to the designated Bitcoin wallet. Once receipt was confirmed, the rest of the ransom payment went through. That was that. Case closed. The company filled out the necessary forms for the insurance claim. The claims adjuster considered the evidence. The lawyers signed off on the paperwork, and the clients went about their business, never having learned that any of their data had been compromised. A longer version of this article appeared in 1843 magazine. We'll do a combination of technology and health and science articles this week, run through, I don't know, four or five of them. We'll start with Golden State, California versus the AI beast. California is angering its most important industry as it seeks legislation to stop real-world disasters caused by AI systems before they happen, said Maxwell Zeff in TechCrunch. State legislators are close to sending a controversial bill to the governor, SB 1047, that holds large tech companies liable for implementing sufficient safety protocols to prevent an AI-fueled catastrophe. Developers will have to build a kill switch button that could shut down the entire AI model if something bad arises. And whistleblower protections have to be granted to employees who disclose information about an unsafe AI model to California's Attorney General. Mitigating threats to humanity seems like a goal we can all agree on, but a growing chorus of Silicon Valley players aren't on the same page. They say that the bill stifles innovation and trashes open source models, which are designed for transparency. Leaders of OpenAI and other companies have said they want to be regulated, said Garrison Lovely in The Nation. But, of course, when a bill is actually proposed, the masks come off. None of the major AI companies support SB 1047, and instead they are blatantly misleading the public by framing it as a radical, industry-destroying measure driven by fears of an imminent sci-fi robot takeover. Nonsense. The actual bill is composed of very popular provisions crafted with extensive input from AI developers and endorsed by world-leading AI researchers. Lawmakers are currently playing catch-up on data privacy and the harms caused by social media because of their failure to act earlier, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. With AI, there are even greater risks to sitting on the sidelines for too long. This bill serves as an important backstop until the federal government decides to act. Except that, as usual, California is strangling itself in red tape, said Greg Fahrenstein in the San Francisco Standard. Legislators seem not to have noticed how many technologists have already left the state en masse in response to new taxes and regulation, leaving a once bustling San Francisco downtown largely empty. Further regulations will do little to make us any safer. AI companies will simply move out and create new wealth elsewhere, continuing to do what they have been doing, good or bad. In any case, the AI fears that California is responding to are starting to look overhyped, said The Economist. The European Union and South Korea have begun to tackle specific and immediate problems associated with AI, such as bias, discrimination, and violation of intellectual property rights. California's effort, by contrast, is too broad. It is founded on a quasi-religious belief that AI poses the risk of large-scale catastrophic harm that is vague and hypothetical, and probably unrealistic. New plan for stranded astronauts. NASA's stranded astronauts will get a lift home from SpaceX next year, said Christian Davenport in the Washington Post. The space agency does not have confidence in Boeing's troubled Starliner capsule, which delivered the two astronauts, Barry Wilmore and Sonny Williams, to the International Space Station in early June for what was supposed to be an 8-day mission. However, the Starliner suffered a series of thruster problems and helium leaks during the flight, leaving NASA worried the astronauts could not return safely. Starliner instead will come back, likely in early September, without anyone on board. SpaceX will fly two astronauts, not four, on its Dragon craft's next planned trip, leaving room for Williams and Wilmore to come home in February. And over on the health and science page, Dodos didn't dodder. Forget everything you think you know about the dodo bird. New research shows that far from a dumpy slowpoke, the flightless bird was actually a swift, powerful runner, well adapted to its Indian Ocean island home on Mauritius. And it wasn't hunted to extinction by humans. It was done in by the mammals that those humans brought with them. The rats, cats, and pigs that ate eggs and chicks from the dodo's nest in the ground. The misconception comes from the lack of contemporaneous drawings and scientific accounts of live dodos. That's because after Dutch sailors arrived at Mauritius in 1598 and took less than 65 years for the species to go extinct. In a new study, researchers examined dodo bones and tissue from collections across the world and combed through centuries' worth of writings to create a more accurate picture. They found that the species had exceptionally powerful tendons in its legs, similar to those of the climbing and running birds of today. It wasn't fat and slow and destined to go extinct, lead researcher Neil Gosling of the University of Southampton tells the Times. It was doing quite well. It just hadn't met with rats and cats. Plastic in the brain. Microplastics have infiltrated our brains, reports The Guardian. Scientists have already found the tiny specks of plastic, smaller than 5 millimeters in diameter, in critical organs like lungs and livers and placentas. Now they have found even greater concentrations in the brain. In a new study still undergoing peer review, researchers measured microplastics in the brains, livers, and kidneys of people who died in 2016 and 2024. Of the 91 samples collected this year, the brains had up to 20 times more microplastics than the livers and kidneys, and 24 of the brains had so much that they were effectively 0.5% plastic by weight. 12 of the samples came from people who'd had dementia, and those brains held up to 10 times more plastic by weight than the others. More concerning, the study found that the amount of microplastics in the 2024 samples was about 50% greater than in the samples from 2016. People are exposed to microplastics through pollution in water, air, and food. It's pretty alarming, says lead author Matthew Campen. There's much more plastic in our brains than I ever would have imagined. Aging's tipping points. Human aging isn't a steady decline. Rather, it happens in two distinct bursts, at ages 44 and 60. That's the conclusion of a new study of 108 people ages 25 to 75 who gave blood, stool, and skin samples as well as an oral and nasal swabs every 3 to 6 months for several years. The researchers examined 135,000 different molecules and microbes in the sample, including bacteria, viruses, fungi, RNA, and proteins, and the results were astonishing. They found that around age 44, people's ability to metabolize caffeine and alcohol drops, and lipid metabolism also decreases. At around age 60, kidney function, carbohydrate metabolism, and immune regulation all diminish rapidly. There are some really dramatic changes, study co-author Michael Snyder of Stanford University tells CNN.com, and that's true no matter what class of molecules you look at. The findings could explain why people in their 40s suddenly can't seem to keep weight off and why those in their 60s see muscle loss. Take care of yourself more closely at specific time points during your lifespan, the study's lead author, Ziato Shin, advises. Jupiter spacecraft slingshots around Earth. A Jupiter-bound spacecraft just performed an impressive trick, The first ever maneuver to harness the gravity of both Earth and the Moon, reports Space.com. The European Space Agency's Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, known affectionately as JUICE, was launched in April 2023, bound for the fifth planet from the Sun, hundreds of millions of miles away. Getting there requires multiple trajectory changes and velocity boosts to be provided by gravitational pull of the planets the craft passes by on its complicated waltz through the solar system. On its first flyby, the gravity of Earth and the Moon helped slow JUICE down a bit and redirected it onto a course for a flyby of Venus in August 2025. That's when the gravity assist will start to accelerate the craft, one assist from Venus, and two more from additional flybys of Earth, in what the ESA calls the space exploration equivalent of drinking three back-to-back espressos. The boost will allow JUICE to reach Jupiter's orbit by July 2031, with much of its fuel still on board, which will allow it to make course adjustments as needed to search for water on the Jovian moons Ganymede, Callisto, and Europa. The gravity assist flyby was flawless, said Ignacio Tanco, the spacecraft operations manager of JUICE. Everything went without a hitch, and we were thrilled to see JUICE coming back so close to Earth. And I think we've got time for a couple of the Talking Points articles. Ketamine. Time to crack down on clinics. Matthew Perry's relationship with ketamine ended in addiction and death, said Daniel Gilbert and Richard Sema in the Washington Post. But the Friends star Deadly Habit began with a legal ketamine session at a Los Angeles clinic, one of up to 750 such clinics across the U.S. that offer the powerful anesthetic to treat depression. Federal indictments unveiled in August detail how the actor, who struggled with substance abuse and depression for decades, became addicted to intravenous infusions of ketamine. When clinic doctors refused to up his dose, two other physicians, Salvadora Placencia and Mark Chavez, allegedly began supplying him with ketamine illicitly. Quote, I wonder how much this moron will pay, Placencia texted Chavez. Perry, 54, spent $55,000 on the drug in a month. He was found dead in his hot tub last October after receiving a shot from his assistant. Five people have been charged in connection with his death, including Placencia, who pleaded not guilty, and Chavez, who entered a plea agreement. Perry's death is a symptom of burgeoning ketamine misuse, said Lisa Jarvis in Bloomberg. Law enforcement seizures of the drug more than tripled from 2017 to 2022, suggesting growing numbers are taking it recreationally. Tesla CEO Elon Musk reportedly takes ketamine to both manage his depression and as a party drug. There's also evidence some legal ketamine clinics are taking advantage of people. The only version of ketamine approved by the FDA to treat depression is the nasal spray Spravato, which must be taken in a doctor's office. Yet any doctor can prescribe the drug off-label as an antidepressant. And some clinics and telehealth firms sell it unproven forms, such as daily microdoses or lozenges. Ketamine clinics have become the Wild West of American medicine, said Samuel T. Wilkinson and T. Greg Ree in Deseret News. The prevailing ethic for doctors in this new era of psychotropic medicine should be to first do no harm. The harm is not the ketamine itself, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. When used with proper guidance, It's a remarkable medication that can help patients overcome debilitating emotional trauma. The danger lies with those who would use it to prey on the ill and vulnerable as a money-making scheme. There will always be pushers, whether it's pharma giants hawking opioid painkillers or high schoolers slinging fentanyl-tainted methamphetamine. The key is to stop their cruelty without banning useful medications. Abortion, Trump's stunning flip-flop. Donald Trump is striking a new tone on abortion, much to the frustration of anti-abortion advocates, said Jessica Piper in Politico, fearing that he'd be punished at the polls for appointing Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade. Trump posted last week that his administration would be great for women and their reproductive rights. He also said that he wouldn't restrict access to abortion pills by mail, as his pro-life allies have advocated. His running mate, J.D. Vance, even said Trump would veto a federal abortion ban if passed by a Republican Congress. Trump claims to have no regrets about making good on his promise to Christian conservatives to get Roe overturned. But abortion has hurt Republicans ever since, with abortion rights amendments winning by landslides in numerous red states. Now he's making a frenzied attempt to reset the narrative, saying each state should decide whether abortion should be legal. Trump's stance is a moral abomination, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. But it's hardly a surprise. After all, he's not a conservative. A real pro-lifer believes life begins at conception and would never say abortion restrictions were too harsh, as Trump called Florida's six-week ban. Trump cares only about his interests, not issues, and he believes that moderating on abortion is in his best interest now. So he's foolishly but predictably returned to his default setting, limousine liberal pro-abortion, New Yorker. And what does Trump get for angering pro-lifers? Pro-choice Democrats and moderates still won't support him. And now he's throwing a critical part of his base under the proverbial bus. The abortion endgame is coming into view, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post. Democrats are united in aiming to legalize abortion nationwide as part of a freedom agenda. Republicans, however, are shaken by the fierce public backlash against strict red state restrictions and lack a clear objective. But Republicans can't hide their goals, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. When Planned Parenthood set up a mobile abortion clinic outside the Democratic National Convention last week, Republicans reacted with levels of hysteria that evoked 17th century Puritan witch hunters, calling it a sick demonstration of the Democrats' depopulation agenda. That reaction underscores the right's obsession with controlling women's bodies, which is why no one should be fooled by Trump's frantic flip-flop. On the poll watch, got a couple of pieces there. 71% of Americans support ending the federal income tax on tip income. And 69% support increasing the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. Just 35% support making it easier for businesses to fight efforts to unionize employees. 54% of Americans think marijuana has a very or somewhat negative effect on society, up from 50% in 2022. 51% say it has a negative effect on people who use it, up from 45% 2 years ago. 13% of adults say they smoke marijuana, while 12% say they consume edibles. And here's a short Only in America piece. Crayola has successfully trademarked the smell of its crayons. The company's initial application was rejected in 2018. But after Crayola appealed, the U.S. Patent Office issued a trademark for a smell described as a slightly earthy soap with pungent, leather clay-like undertones. CEO Pete Ruggiero said the Crayola smell could be pumped into stores to trigger shoppers' childhood nostalgia. And we got time for a couple of quotes. Benjamin Franklin said, "If everyone is thinking alike, then no one is thinking." And from former House Speaker Sam Rayburn, "Any jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a good carpenter to build one." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.